Perashat Vayichi Yaakov, the last perasha in Sefer Bereshit. Of course, the perasha is famous for the blessings that Yaakov Avinu bestows to his children before he dies, Berchat Yaakov, and then the eventual demise of Yaakov Avinu and his burial. In the first pasuk, however, there is a interesting observation that I saw from one of the rabbis. Pasuk writes, "Vayichi Yaakov be'eres Misrayim shiva esre shana." Yaakov lived in Egypt for 17 years. You see, he lived altogether 147 years. But he came down to Egypt at 130, and he lived there for the last 17 years of his life. And the Torah says, "Vayhi yeme Yaakov shene hayav." And the days of Yaakov's life, the years of his life. It's a very strange way of saying the years of his life. It says, Vayhi yeme Yaakov, and the days of Yaakov's life were the years of his life, 147. It's funny, the days, the years. If somebody asks you, how many years? You say years. You don't say, my days are, my years are. What does it mean? Yeme Yaakov shene hayav. How do we understand that? So I saw one of the rabbis said a beautiful observation. Days go by quickly. Years go by a little slower. To Yaakov Avinu, since he's involved all day long in religious pursuit, since he's involved all day long learning and praying and doing God's work, his years went by so quickly like days. And that's a very important lesson. When people are involved in religious pursuit, they never have enough time. They always feel they're being rushed. They wish there was 10 more hours during the day. Their life goes by in a flash. And therefore the pasuk says, Vayhi yeme Yaakov shene hayav. Even though it was the years that he lived, it felt to him like it was days. Because the tzaddikim are always pressed for more time. Since they have such an important mission in life, therefore they can't squander it. And therefore they always feel that it's going by too quickly. Hence, 147 years is like yeme hayav. It's like days. They tell a story once of a rabbi called the Bnei Yisaschar. The Bnei Yisaschar once went to a shopping place, a mall maybe you'd call it, something like that. And he saw some men just hanging around, talking, you know, not doing anything, wasting time. So they said, the rabbi said to them, well, what are you people doing? What are you involved in? So they spoke to him in Yiddish. They said in Yiddish something like, we're chasing the time away. We would say we're killing time. They said we're chasing the time away. So the rabbi says, you're chasing the time away? Chase it to me then. Chase it my way. I need more time. And that's the lesson. And that's why when Adam HaRishon, he reached the ripe old age of 930, he started complaining to God. He said, it's not fair. I was supposed to really live to 1,000. But God said, but you gave up 70 years to David HaMelech. That's a good thing. You know, you signed a contract on it. 930 is a lot. And Adam HaRishon had to be coerced by God. Listen, you have to keep your word. You can't renege on it. But if Adam had a chance, he would have reneged on it in order to gain another 70 years. To show you, tzaddikim that are using their life for important things, time is of the essence, and therefore it goes by very quickly. That's why Moshe Rabbeinu, at the end of his life, he prays 515 prayers in order to enter Eretz Yisrael. You'd say to yourself, hey, listen, Moshe, you're accomplished. There's nobody greater than you. Die, go to Olam Abba, and that's it. Enjoy yourself. Well, what do you have to press God for 515 prayers? You know, if you need time to make teshuvah, maybe you made some sins, you need to repair things, okay, you need time. But you did everything good. And the explanation is, again, that tzaddikim want to live because their life to them is very fast. Because they always feel that there's higher levels to attain. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam shekol yom baro. Pasuk writes that Yaakov Abinu calls his son Yosef, and he tells him, "Imna matzati chen be'einecha, please, if I find favor in your eyes, simna yadecha tahat yerechi, please swear to me, ve'asita imadi chesed ve'emet. I want you to do for me a chesed, a kindness, but a true kindness. A real, legitimate, true chesed." So the rabbis ask, what is this thing, the true chesed? Is there a chesed that's not true? They say, wait, there's one type of chesed that is the ideal chesed, and that is burying the dead. Why is that an ideal chesed? Because all other favors that we do for people, we anticipate reciprocation. Whether we anticipate it at the top of our mind or in our heart, there's an anticipation. You gave somebody a lift. In the back of your mind, you say, one day I'll also need a lift, and now he'll be able to pay me back. You lend somebody something. One day you'll need it and go with him because you feel he owes you something. That's the way it works. So no chesed is really chesed shel emet, you know, a pure chesed. Because it's inevitable. You always have that ulterior motive, even in your heart of hearts, that somehow it's going to come back to you. But there's one type of chesed where we don't anticipate reciprocation. And where's that? That's when you go to bury a dead. When you go to a funeral. So one of the rabbis asked, what do you mean? The Gemara teaches us that somebody that goes to a funeral and eulogizes, they will eulogize him. Midah keneged midah. Somebody that goes to a cemetery, God forbid, and buries the dead, the Gemara assures him, you buried the dead, you will be buried. So therefore you do see that even this chesed, you get paid for. You get reciprocated for. So maybe it's not a chesed shel emet. Maybe a person goes to a funeral and at the funeral he's thinking, alright, it's good I came because I want this to happen to me also. I don't want to die and people forget me. Just like I gave respect to Mr. So-and-so, I know that I'm going to get the same respect. I know I'll be eulogized. I know I'll be buried. So how could we call it chesed shel emet if indeed there is a payback? So I saw an explanation. They say, you're right. There will be a payback for going to funerals, but you don't care about it. You don't care. You're not thinking about that. When we go to a funeral, God forbid, when people go to funerals, they have a different perspective. Life becomes very clear to them what's important. At a time of a funeral, you're not thinking about kavod. At a time of funeral, you're not thinking, oh, one day I'll get this also, where they'll talk about, who cares about kavod? You're thinking about your personal respect at that time? When a person sees what's going on at a funeral, he has such a clarity on life that these things don't matter. He's not thinking reciprocation. He's too focused on the priorities of life. So yes, he will get rewarded, but he's not thinking of it. That's what it means, chesed shel emet. All other times you do chesed, maybe you're thinking about reciprocation. But at a funeral, that's the last thing on your mind. Because you're so clear on what life is and what the important things of life. You think a person's going to think about kavod at a funeral? Oh, look, I did this for him. Now they're going to do this for me. Heaven forbid it wouldn't cross anybody's mind at a funeral when you're at the epitome of truth. When you're at the epitome of what life is, then already these things are removed from you. So that's what it means. It's chesed shel emet. You don't anticipate to get a reward. Unfortunately, these feelings of clarity dissipate very quickly. Sometimes it takes 15 minutes and we leave a funeral, and that priority and that vision that we have of what life is dissipates, and then we go back to our daily routine. Unfortunately, they haven't figured out a way yet to preserve that clarity. I was once at a funeral, Bar Minan, of a young girl in the community that passed away. There were a lot of young people there. and I was sitting sitting next to somebody who had called me the day before, actually complaining and whining about his car that got banged up. And he said, why does God do this to me? And it's not right, and it's not fair. And he had questions, and he had problems. And as a young boy, teenager, obviously these things are going to bother them. So I sat next to him, and as they brought the coffin in, I turned to the fellow, the young boy, and I said, tell me the story about your car again right now. I want to hear the story. He said, Rabbi, what car? What are you talking about? I said, what do you mean? Yesterday, this was, he says, I can't believe it. I'm embarrassed. So I said, oh, he has clarity. It clicked. He says, Rabbi, I'm focused right now. Don't even get me involved. The car means shtuyot. The car's nothing. But wouldn't you believe, 2 hours after the funeral, when it wore off, he called me again and said, back to the car, Rabbi. Where were we with the car? So you see, unfortunately, we don't know how to preserve these moments, because if we did, and Shlomo HaMelech said, and God forbid that this should not be ever fulfilled, this pasuk, but he does say that if a person has an option to go to Bar Minan, a funeral or a party or a wedding, Shlomo says you can only do one. Where should you go to? He says, go to the funeral. Bar Minan, Shlomo HaMelech, what a morbid answer. Who wants to go to a funeral? Go to a wedding, dance. Masameh hatam v'kala. Says, because at a funeral, you'll receive the proper perspective on life. You'll receive that clarity. Unfortunately, like I said, sometimes even at the funeral itself, we don't know how to behave and we don't know how to sit with respect. Rabbis are trying to make eulogies. Whether we understand them or not, whether we feel that they have the proper dictum, whether we feel they have the proper topic, that's not the issue. But when the rabbi is speaking at a funeral, and the disrespect of the men and the ladies, they start talking to each other and they get fidgety. You know, it's one thing if cell phones go off in a class when a rabbi is trying to make a point. This we could tolerate. But at a funeral, which is the epitome of disrespect for a man, there's less respect, and a cell phone that's going off so that it can remind him that he has to pick up a dozen eggs on the way home from the funeral. It's outrageous. Simple courtesy for kavod ha'met doesn't have to be said. Well, the more so talking. If you don't understand what the rabbi is saying or you don't appreciate his words, sit with your eyes closed in solemn thought or stare at the coffin and receive the proper insight. It's not enough when we talk, we ruin it for ourselves, but many times we spoil it for the people that are around us that are also trying to get inspired. You're there already, so you might as well take advantage of it. Shlomo HaMelech, if he would see sometimes the fiasco that goes on at funerals, then he might tell us, better go to a wedding, forget about it, dance with the Hatam V'Kala, because you're not going to get the message anyway. And as I said, unfortunately, the trick is, and I don't have it figured out yet exactly personally, to preserve that moment. I'll never forget. There was a major funeral in the community. God forbid, it's a morbid topic. It's the Parasha Vayechi Yaakov, and it was in the summer. It was in Deal, and it was on Route 35, and it made a terrible impact on the community. It was a major tragedy. And I said to myself, I said, this one cannot wear off that quickly, because the speeches were very inspiring and there was thousands of people there. And to my dismay, as I was walking out, standing on Route 35, I hear two men behind me and said, meet me at the golf range in 15 minutes and we'll shoot some golf balls. In front of the mat, in front of the kevet, in front of the people are there, they're crying, you're staring at the family. Look how fragile human beings are, that they're able to forget right away. That's why our rabbis were so smart when they told us, don't trust anybody, even your best friends. You can only trust at the end of the day the mitzvot and the Torah that you did. At the end of the day, Bar Minan, a person will die, his friends will come to the funeral, and right after that, they'll go putting, they'll go golfing. Finish, it's over, see you later, we miss you. And next, they forgot about you. It's unfortunate, and it sounds very cruel, But as human beings, life goes on. Next subject. What are we? We're not going to cry all day long. We're not going to pray for him all day long. Next, we did it. We paid last respects. What are we going to do now? And move on. The only thing, even the family, okay, they go visit, they mourn for a year, but then they also get over it. At the end of the day, what is going to stand for a person after 120? The only loyal friend that's going to remain with him and stand with him and protect him and advocate for him is his Torah and the mitzvot. Everything, his money will be shared by inheritors, gone, never to help him again. His friends, like we said, and even his family, and therefore we can only rely on Torah and mitzvot. The Torah continues and tells us, "Vehi achara devarim ha'ele," was after these events. Vayomer leYosef, Yosef gets a message. Hine avicha chole. They tell him, "Behold, your father is sick." The rabbis tell us a very interesting insight over here. This was the first time anybody in history ever got sick. Until that moment, the Torah tells us people would sneeze, perfectly healthy. They don't have any ailments, any indications of weakness. All of a sudden they sneeze, and then the neshama would be snuffed out, and finished, they died. There was no warning, there was no signal. That's why we have a custom today, when somebody sneezes, we say, L'chaim tovim, Gesundheit, L'briyut. Why do we say that? Because in the olden days, when a person sneezed, that's it, he died. So today we say, L'chaim tovim. We want to reverse that old custom that used to take place. So here, Yaakov Avinu prayed to God, Hashem, I don't want to die like that. I don't want sudden death. I want a warning. So all of a sudden, they notice Yaakov Avinu, he's on his bed, he can't move, he's lethargic. They never saw such a thing before. It's either you're healthy or you're dead. There's no such thing as sick. So they came running to you and said, I can't believe it. Your father, he's sick. They had to make up a new word probably for this concept. And why did he want to get sick? I mean, because you ask yourself a question. You know, maybe it's better, but I mean, not a guy who has to die anyway. So he said, die suddenly. And next, once it gets sick and you have to suffer and there's problems and complications. I mean, Yaakov is praying for something that you say, you know, better we don't have it. Let's, if the guy has to die, let it be over very quickly without any pain. Yaakov obviously made a judgment over here. He made a ruling. His judgment was that it's more important for him to know when he's going to pass away in order that he can have an opportunity to instruct his children before he dies, what path to take. Sudden death, you don't know. Boom, he dies, over. He wasn't able to tell Reuven one last will that he wanted from him. Or he wasn't able to rebuke Shimon and Levi. Or he wasn't able to guide Yehuda or Yosef. When a person has time, where he knows it's coming, so therefore he's able to put his life in order. As a matter of fact, some of the greatest Hachamim before they died, they use those moments in order to leave a last will and testament to their children. The Hatam Sofer, a great rabbi, he left in his will, he called his daughters and his daughters-in-law into the room, and he warned them. He says, please behold, and as I'm going to die soon, please, I beseech you one thing, please follow the laws of modesty. Please follow the laws of Sini'ut. You see, the Hatam Sofer got that last opportunity to give those words of Musar. And you could imagine the impact it makes when you're hearing it from somebody that you know is about to die. And that's what he's thinking about, Sini'ut. You remember, that was a priority to my father on his deathbed. He put everything aside and said, please, Achi, like I'm just asking you for one favor, dress modestly. That was the Hatam Sofer. There was a rabbi called the Netziv. The Netziv, he said before he died the following. He called his son in. His son's name was Rav Chaim Berlin. That's the name. They named the yeshiva on Coney Avenue after him, Rav Chaim Berlin. It's the Netziv's son. The Netziv was the Rosh Yeshiva in Volozhin. So he said like this. He said, many rabbis, they tell their children before they die, I don't want any eulogies at the funeral. He said, I'm not going to tell you that. Because we find in the Gemara, many great rabbis eulogized and received eulogies. So he said, I'm not better than the rabbis. The rabbis of the Gemara accepted eulogies on themselves. So I also accept the eulogy. I'm not better than the Amoraim. But then he told his son like this. But I'll tell you the truth. He said, I know you're a great speaker. You're a great orator. And you're a great darshan. And I have no doubt you're going to expend a lot of energy and a lot of time in preparing a very eloquent, long eulogy. Do me a favor. For my soul, don't make the eulogy long. Eulogize, but don't spend a long time preparing it and a long time delivering it. I'd rather you learn a perek of Mishnayot or a page of Gemara in that time instead of the eulogy, and that will elevate my soul much higher to the highest levels. And that's a great lesson you learn from the Netziv. Certainly eulogies are important and they elevate the soul. But there is nothing that can elevate a soul of somebody that has departed more than the study of Mishnayot or the study of Gemara. Actually, the word Mishnah is composed of the same letters as the word Neshama. So you see, Mishnah and Neshama, there's a very strong connection. Therefore, the greatest thing, if you wanted to do something for somebody that was Niftar, it's either to study yourself or to support people that are studying in memory of the Niftar's name, and certainly that will bring the Neshama to the highest levels. I saw one of the rabbis say a nice observation. I heard, it seems Yosef didn't know that his father was sick. He needed to be told. Pasuk says, Vayomer le Yosef. They came to Yosef and said, behold, your father's sick. How come Yosef didn't know? Yosef was a delinquent? Well, he wasn't with his father? He has to get news from somebody else, third party, your father's sick? Where was Yosef? You'd expect him to be with his father? I mean, he didn't see him in 22 years. You'd expect him to be with him 24 hours a day by his side. What does it mean he needed to be told? So one of the Rishonim answered, the Da'at Zekenim Ba'alei HaTosafot, says a very, very sharp answer. He says, Yosef actually spent limited time with Yaakov on purpose. He didn't want to be with Yaakov all the time. Why not? So he says, because he knew if he was going to spend time with them, inevitably the story of his sale being sold down to Egypt is going to come up. And he's going to have to start telling his father details, what the brothers did. Because at this point, Yaakov doesn't know exactly the details, how the brothers brought Yosef down to Egypt, or what they tried to kill him, and the whole story. It's vague in Yaakov's mind. But if he's going to be with him, what's going to happen if Yaakov Abinu asks him? So, tell me the story. Tell me what happened. How'd you get here? Then he's going to have to indict the brothers. And then Yaakov Avinu, he was scared, he's going to get so upset. What? That's what they did to you? And who knows, he can curse them. So therefore, he was limited in his association to Yaakov. Look at the level of Yosef. You can imagine how much he wished to be with his father. And how much he loved his brothers. He didn't want to say Lashon Hara to his father if he's asked. And therefore, he's going to jeopardize his brothers. It's an amazing level. Rabbi Gifter says, Alav Hashalom said a chidush on this. Hard to understand what Rabbi Gifter said here. It's not an easy explanation, he says. But he says, you know why Yosef didn't spend time with Yaakov? Because he knew Yosef is a king. Halakha says you have to respect the king. So it means every time Yosef's going to walk into the room, Yaakov's going to stand up for him. Yaakov is going to tend to him. Yaakov is going to treat him with kavod. He says, I'm going to make my father respect me, and therefore he didn't want to get involved. He brings a proof. He says there was a rabbi called the Maharam Mirotenburg. The Maharam Mirotenburg, his father was a rabbi also, but Maram Rutenberg was a gadol. So he also shunned away from going into meetings with his father because he knew his father was going to give him great respect. Just a hard explanation because this is Yaakov's pride. This is his pleasure, maybe. So like you're depriving your father from a visitation, which he would probably enjoy because you don't want him to respect you. But if you make the challenge, he'd probably say, Yaakov would rather you come and he'd stand up for you and forget about it. But this is a calculation, obviously, of Gedolim. Torah continues. Torah tells us, Yosef now brings his children into Yaakov, their grandfather, in order to receive a blessing. You're familiar with the episode. Yaakov Avinu switches his hands, Sikelet Yadav, and he gives Ephraim, who was the younger son, the primary blessing, and Menashe, who was the older of the two, he gives them the secondary blessing, so to speak. And Yosef tries to correct him. Yosef says, Dad, you're mixing it up. And Yaakov says, Yadati b'ni yadati. Don't worry about it. I know everything that's going on. I didn't go senile. I have clarity. I know exactly what I'm doing. And he gives them a blessing. And what is the blessing he says? Becha yivarech Yisrael. Tells them, boys, through you, people are going to bless their children. When a father is going to come and bless his son, what is he going to say? He's not going to say, let my son be like Reuven and Shimon. He's not going to say, let my son be like Yisachar and Zebulun. Let my son be like Dan and Naphtali. When a father comes to bless his son, he's going to say, Yisimecha Elohim ke Ephraim v'chimnashe. You are going to be the epitome of blessing that parents will give their children. And we want to understand, this blessing, incidentally, that we still give our children on a weekly basis. It's our custom on Friday night that when the sons, after Kiddush, come and kiss their father's hand, the father blesses them with this exact blessing, Yisimecha Elohim Ke'efraim V'chimnashe. We do it every week. What is this blessing? Did we ever think for a moment, what are you telling your children? You should be like Ephraim and Menashe. What's so special about Ephraim and Menashe? Many explanations you could imagine were said to try to explain the essence of this blessing. One explanation is, Menashe, he seemingly got chipped. He's the oldest son, and here his younger brother gets the primary beracha. We have a precedence to this in history. You know, when Cain and Hevel, when Cain felt that his younger brother upstaged him, Cain went crazy. Cain went into a rage, and he ended up killing Hevel. Go read the story of Yishmael and Yitzhak. I mean, Yishmael technically was older. And when he felt that Yitzhak is getting a benefit, so Yishmael tried to kill him. And the same thing happened with Esav and Yaakov. Throughout history, Yosef and the brothers, perfect example. Yosef is the youngest son, the brothers are older, they felt Yosef is upstaging. Every situation where we saw siblings in the Torah, where the older brother felt that the younger brother is getting more, it ended up in machloket, it ended up in jealousy, it ended up in trouble. The only case where you don't see any problems, it ends up with a happy ending, is Menashe and Ephraim. Here, Menashe is told by Yaakov, you're number two. What do you mean, I'm one? You know, you're number two, and your brother who's younger, he's number one. What's Menashe's reaction? Beautiful. I'm happy. Shalom Israel. I accept it. No jealousy. What better blessing could we give our children? On Friday night, you should be like Menashe and Ephraim. That whatever happens in the family, the brothers should never fight. There should not be machloket. What will happen one day if one brother becomes very wealthy and another brother, he doesn't make it? Now all of a sudden there's jealousy and there's rivalry and there's machloket and there's hatred. We tell our children, in those formidable years of their life, remember Menashe and Ephraim. It's a classic case where somebody got more than the other, and the brothers, they lived with it. You know, Ephraim didn't stick it in Menashe's face either. Say, I got the main blessing because I learned Torah and you don't. That's why Grandpa likes me better. He didn't say anything. He accepted it. Menashe accepted it. It was the epitome of peace. What bigger blessing can we give our children to learn from these two giants how to accept what God has in store for you without having claims against one another? You took it, it's mine, it's not fair, I'm older, and so on and so forth. There's another explanation that was said. It's clear from the Pesukim that Menashe, he was more worldly. Torah tells us he was like the assistant of Yosef in Egypt. When we talk about the brothers coming down, they were talking to Yosef in Hebrew. Yosef knew Hebrew, but he had to give the impression that he didn't understand Hebrew, so they had an interpreter. Who was the interpreter? Menashe. So you see, Menashe was like Yosef's right-hand man. He's like in charge of operations. So he's more worldly. He's involved in the mundane world. Ephraim, on the other hand, it's clear from the Pesukim, he was always learning. Especially when Yaakov Abinu came down to Egypt, it says Ephraim sat with Yaakov for those 17 years. He didn't leave his side, and he learned with him all the Torah. So you see two sons over here. One son, Ephraim, epitomizes learning. But we cannot deny the fact that even the best learners and even the most devout people that are studying need to support themselves. They need to get involved somewhat, somehow, in order to bring a parnasah. They have to supply food for their family. They cannot let their children starve, God forbid, or let their family suffer on account of their studying. So in life, you need Ephraim's Torah, and you also need Menashe's effort, Menashe's ishtadlut. And therefore, we bless our children. Yisimecha Elohim keEphraim v'chemenashe. You should be both. You should have the learning of Ephraim. You should be devout and studying. But also, you should have a little of Menashe also. You should have the ability where you're able to make sure that there's sustenance and there's parnasah, and you have to get involved a little in order to make sure that the support is there. But it should be pointed out. It should be pointed out very clearly. Yesimecha Elohim ke'Ephraim v'chemenashe. We tell our children, remember, Ephraim is the priority, not Menashe. Ephraim comes first. Your Torah career is the most important. And even those that go out into the business world, and even those that are in the city and they're making money, or professionals, we remind our children, that's not the priority in life. That's something you have to do. That's something that, unfortunately, the way God created the world, you must go out and expend energy to make a parnasah. It's a curse. We don't say, no, God says it's a curse. If Adam and Eve never ate from the tree, we'd be able to sit and learn all day long. We'd never have to work, and money would grow from the trees. But because he ate, so God said, now you're going to have to sweat. But no, don't make your career a priority. Unfortunately, many people that get involved in business and career, it overtakes them and it becomes an obsession. And they always give a claim, well, when I get older, I'll retire and then I'll go study Torah. But who knows? It's like a vacuum. It sucks you in. And therefore we tell our children, Yesimecha Elohim, you need both. But Ke'Ephraim v'chemenashe, always see to it that Ephraim's message of devout study, that is the primary goal in your life. Further on in the parasha, Torah tells us when he was blessing his children, Pasuk says, he came to his son Yisachar. Interesting Pasuk by Yisachar. Yaakov tells Yisachar, Vayar menucha kitov, v'ta'ares ki na'ema, v'yet shechmo lesbo. It says Yisachar, he saw that rest, menucha, rest is good. He understood, resting is a good thing. And he saw the pleasantness of the land. So what did he do? He lowered his shoulder and worked diligently. And all the rabbis question. Doesn't make sense. You saw rest is good. So what do? You go to work? That's the wrong reaction. It should say he saw work was good, so he went to work. Bayar minuha kitov, he said, minuha, peace of mind. He saw ease. Oh, that's the greatest thing in the world. So what was his reaction? Like a guy says, he saw that vacationing is great. So what did he do? He said, I'm going to work 365 days. Yeah, I'm not taking a vacation. What are you talking about? Tell me he vacated all year round. So explanation is, there's two types of menucha. There's two types of peace. One type of peace we're familiar with. That's the peace that we have on a vacation. Person goes to a place where it's a different scenery, the weather's a little different, he puts on different clothes, he relaxes, it's quiet, he drinks a little, he's inactive. He sits and just slows down, he's comfortable, he has, what can we say, he has a vacation. Menucha. But how long could you do that without going crazy? How long could you stay on vacation until you say you're going batty and you have to get back? It happens to a lot of people. I'm not only saying if you have kids where you miss your children. I'm not only saying that. Even just relaxing, eventually you get crazy. You want to do something. You have to go somewhere. You can't just sit and do nothing all day long. Even vacation can become the most tiresome and cumbersome burden after it ends. And therefore, that type of menucha is not a real menucha. The real menucha in life is when people are active. And you know it yourself. You feel much better about yourself, at ease with yourself, on the days that you've accomplished things. On the days that you did things. On the days that you went, you did 100 errands, and you went here, and you went there, and you cooked, and you bought, and you went, and you said, you come home, you feel good. Wow, I accomplished a lot today. Or the day where you just sat on the couch and relaxed, it's relaxing. Menuchak is good. But you don't feel that inner peace that you did something. There's a void. And therefore it says, Vayar menuchakitov. Yisachar sees the true peace in life. The true peace in life only comes through accomplishment. The true serenity in life only comes through action, through doing. So he says, I want to acquire this real peace. Therefore, Vayetchech Molesbol, he says, back to work. The only way to acquire this is through work. Unfortunately, our society doesn't understand this. Our society has taught that when people reach the age of 65, finished, they can retire. And for the first couple of weeks, the person retires, he feels good, he doesn't have to go to work anymore. But after that, life becomes very boring. He has no function. He has no purpose. He has nothing to do. He becomes bored. He gets nervous. He feels a vacuum. Person that's used to producing for 65 years, and all of a sudden, they retire him. To what? To sit on a park bench and feed pigeons, to listen to a radio, or to read newspapers. How many newspapers could you read? And therefore, on the contrary, person wants to retire from one type of work, but he can't retire from life. He has to continue living. And therefore, the greatest thing we could do to aging parents and grandparents, never retire them. We have to get projects for them, keep them busy, keep them active, keep them doing. Because so long as they're doing and active, that's the greatest peace of mind that one can accomplish. In Yisachar's case, it was in learning. In Yisachar's case, it was in studying. I know myself. When we're studying in the Kollel, it's a different head. You have work, even though it's rigorous. You have to be there a certain time. You have to produce a certain amount. You have to do. But you're moving. Therefore, it puts you in a different frame of mind. But once vacation time hits, the first few days are enjoyable, but then you start to get a little antsy. You say, what are we doing? We're wasting time. We have to get back. It's inactive. You say, what do you mean, enjoy your vacation? How can you enjoy a vacation? You'd rather be in the grind of life, which really brings a person to true minuha. And that's what it was saying. Yes, he saw minuha is good. Real minuha can only be attained by Vayet Shechmol, is Paul, by lowering your back and accomplishing more work.